Thank you, Matt. So as Dr. Gray said, I'm basically just going to give you a quick identification guide, show you some pretty pictures, kind of show you the key characteristics of the salamanders that we have in the state. So just a little background. We have right now about 55 species, depending on what your species definition is. Some have argued maybe upwards of 60. We kind of have a competition with Georgia, who has the most salamander species, in North Carolina. And so I'd say we have 57, 58, puts us 42. But they seem to disagree. But obviously, it's a very diverse salamander fauna that we have. The majority of those are found in a single family. The Plethodontidae, so those are the lungless salamanders, it's the most common type that we have. But we do have seven families represented in the state. Five of those are represented just by a single species. So things like the hellbender, the amphioma, the siren, the newt, or eastern newt, all represented by a single species for their representative families. So kind of get into the nuts and bolts of it then. We'll start off with the toughest group, and the desmognathine salamanders, desmognathus. Very diverse group. Highest diversity, obviously, is here in the Smoky Mountains, where you can find between 5 and 7 locality, depending on the habitat that you're looking at, which is pretty amazing for a single genus. The only other area where I've seen 5 members of the same genus in Tennessee, there's actually a pond in Middle Tennessee at Arnold Air Force Base where you can get 5 envistomated salamanders in a single net haul, which is pretty amazing. I'll talk more about that here in a little bit. But to get started, we'll talk about the spotted dusky salamander, Desmognathus conidi. Kind of see its distribution here, extending here into eastern Tennessee, Middle Tennessee, then on down south into the coastal plain. Historically, this has been treated as a subspecies of just the dusky salamander, Desmognathus fuscus. There's still some debate about which is which, because you look at them and they're morphologically just about indistinguishable, even in their contact zone. This is a very variable group, coloration-wise, size-wise, some of the habitats that you can find them in, which makes it very difficult, unless you've been at a locality several times and you have other species to compare it to know that's a spotted dusky, yes, that's a black-bellied salamander, but it's one of those things, if you send even the specialist like Steve Tilley, a specimen of Desmognathus, if you don't tell him where it's from, he's not going to be able to tell you exactly what it is. Same thing with the mountain dusky salamander group. I mean, that's how difficult they kind of are. They're very cryptic in their diversity, which is kind of interesting in itself. So yeah, so this image down here, you can see we have a broad area of integration. No one has examined that at all from even a morphological or genetic perspective, so there's a lot of work to be done for sure. What's kind of unique, though, this is kind of exhibits a similar or the typical salamander life cycle where they lay aquatic eggs, have aquatic larvae that then metamorphose into a terrestrial adult or semi-terrestrial adult. What's kind of unique though, there's a lot of variation within this group just here within Tennessee. This is a clutch of eggs that I found actually 2 feet above a stream. So actually the female laid the eggs on land. She's actually, you can't see real well. Maybe kill the front lights a little bit more so you guys get a little better contrast. But there's about 25 hatchlings that were maybe an inch long, and she's kind of moved back in here, but they were laid well above the stream level underneath a moist log, whereas this clutch of eggs that we found here with an intending female is actually laid in a gravel bank. So we were looking actually for Gerinophilus and dug through and found these eggs and found the females in attendance. So they vary in exactly where they oviposit their eggs, which is pretty interesting. I guess I could use this fancy technology. Okay.
What are some of the key characteristics, Matt, of identifying that animal?
Oh, that's probably a good point. Maybe I should go back. So for the Desmognathus in general, they're very robust and stocky. What the key thing to look for, and I'll show you some images of Plethodon, this will be more pronounced, but they have very large jaw muscles. And some of the larger species, like black-bellied salamanders, that can grow upwards of 9 inches can actually give you a pretty good pinch, good bite, much like a skink could. It's a lot of pressure, so they're very robust. Another key characteristic is that they have much larger hind limbs than front limbs, which enables them to kind of hop and almost jump. And so if you've ever held one of these salamanders in your hand, you'll notice they're really kind of frisky, like to jump and get out of the way. Another key characteristic of this species in particular is that it has a semi-keeled tail. And so by keel, we're talking almost like a ship coming to a point at the top versus a round tail, which would be used to identify a couple of the other species of Desmonathus. They don't necessarily have a tail fin, but you can see this ridge that runs down the length of the tail. And coloration-wise, they're all going to have this kind of brownish, auburn, drab ground color. Some will have very vivid spots, almost forming, sometimes will coalesce into a stripe or a wavy stripe. As they get older, they tend to become more melanistic, so that kind of fills in. Other populations don't really even have that. They'll have them as larvae and as juveniles, and they'll quickly lose that. So there's a lot of variation that can be seen. Okay, the Santitla dusky salamander, kind of endemic to the Smoky Mountain Blue Ridge province here. See the distribution. Can be quite abundant in the park in certain areas. It's been known to hybridize with spotted dusky salamanders based on some allozyme and other genetic evidence, which is kind of troublesome. But the key thing to look for with the dusky, this species of dusky salamander, is that kind of disregard the dorsal ground color. If you see a yellowish wash kind of underneath the limbs here at the base of the tail, there's a good chance that's probably going to be this species of salamander, a species of dusky salamander. They also don't grow near as large. They're a little bit smaller. So whereas the spotted dusky salamander might grow 5 or 6 inches in total length, that includes the tail, this one is maybe 4 to 5 max. Another key characteristic I'll point out with Desmognathus, if you can see it really well in this picture, is that if you look right here by the jaw, from the eye down to the margin of the jaw, you see this kind of whitish, yellowish, lighter stripe. And that's typically characteristic of all Desmognathus.
That one's really kind of got a red tint to it. Isn't it? Yeah, I mean, at least that photo does, because a lot of the ones we see in the park,
they're usually kind of drab, usually don't see much dorsal coloration. They're really nondescript. This one actually had very vivid coloration, which is probably atypical. It's not the best representative photo. But yeah, if you turn this animal over, and I wish I had a good shot of that. I didn't have any ethanol or other anesthetic agent to put him under to get him to flip over to get a good photo. But yeah, you'll see this very distinct yellowish wash. That's the key thing to look for. Whereas like the spotted dusky salamander, their venters, and particularly in the base of the tail and the limbs, is going to be kind of a salt and pepper, a dark gray type color. So yeah, habitat-wise, these will be found in very similar habitats to spotted dusky, so they're kind of stream edge. You'll find them underneath rocks. If you're out at night, you'll see them out foraging around. You can even drive the road. One of my fun things to do is during the fall and summer, wait till like 10, 11 o'clock if it's a wet, rainy night so you don't get the traffic. But go up to the park and just run the road that runs from Gatlinburg to Townsend. And if it's raining out, you will find so many species of salamander just walking out over the roads, even ones that are very aquatic, even like black-belly salamanders in two lines, spring salamanders you'll find out moving around. And you can find these guys as well. But they'll be typically at higher elevations, so upwards 2,500 feet and above. Below that, supposedly, it's mostly coned eye. You can use that as kind of a general guide. About 2,500 to 3,000 feet. So one of your sites that you'll go to, Chimney Tops, will be around 3,500 to 3,600 feet. So you'll find these guys around there. Won't be near as numerous because they're kind of outnumbered by black bellies. We'll show them here in a minute. Oops, let's back up. So seal salamanders, this is a really neat species of Desmognathus. They get their name, their common name, from the fact that you'll find them many times at night, just sitting out on a rock, looking like a seal basking. Supposedly how they got their common name. Again, a typical looking Desmognathus. Kind of the unique feature to distinguish them from other species is this lighter transition. So if you notice before, here on the sides and on the venter, it was very dark. The dark ground color pigmentation was found all through there. There's a marked transition from the dorsum to to the sides in pigment. They usually lack pigment, and they're much lighter on the venter. Another characteristic, you can kind of see the general shape of where their larval spots used to be. There's usually just a dark brown color with some border of black pigment, almost like a reticulation throughout, even on this individual here. They grow a little bit larger as well. They can get up to 7-8 inches. So obviously if you find a big adult, they're much easier to tell. The problem is when you find, it's distinguishing between younger seal salamanders and spotted dusky salamanders. That can be quite difficult. This profile image here, again, you can see the very large jaw muscles characteristic of the Desmognathus. Like the other two species, you can also notice this very distinctly keeled, triangular-shaped tail. Again, you can see their distribution is pretty much the higher elevations of East Tennessee on up into Pennsylvania and some scattered populations down into Alabama. Recent molecular work has kind of shown that this group is kind of messy and actually interdigitated within a Coe salamander, so it's kind of had a complex history that phylogeneticists are trying to work out now, which is probably what we're going to find with a lot of these widespread salamander groups, particularly in the Plethodontidae.
This particular species is pretty strongly correlated with water.
Yeah, you'll definitely find them around stream edges for sure. They're a little bit more aquatic than maybe Santitla or spotted duskies, but similar type of habitat. And there's some records even from Middle Tennessee that I find semi-questionable. Again, with that variation in a lot of these groups, like the spotted duskies, even in Monticola, without having genetic evidence to kind of corroborate morphological characteristics, can be very difficult to assign any of these Desmognathian salamanders to species. So you just give it your best educated guess when you're out in the field. This one's a little bit easier to tell apart. Black-bellied salamander, Desmognathus quadrimaculatus. Key characteristic, it's a very distinct black belly. When you see these out in the field, it's very, very obvious. It's completely jet black coloration, whereas most of the other Desmognathus will have a salt and pepper or a grayish colored venter. Other thing that's kind of unique about them is they'll get the largest size, the largest Desmognathian salamander that we have. I think the record length is a little bit over 9 inches, like 9 1/4, which is super large. This one here we caught in the park came in at 8.5. It was a big female, so we thought it was going to be a record and came up short. But again, very large, robust size, very bulbous eyes. You can see very getting that big jaw muscle. Very robust and stocky, and you can see definitely in this picture how much larger those hind limbs are compared to the front limbs. Ground color-wise, even as larvae, they lack those very distinct larval spots and juvenile coloration that you see in the other Desmognathus. So even a smaller size, and they'll also already have that jet black coloration, so pretty easy to tell. And that's the wrong, don't pay no attention to this range map. That one's incorrect. Pay attention to this one down here. I just noticed that as well. This is what happens when you try to put something together fast. So, yeah, they're definitely kind of a Blue Ridge, Southern Appalachians endemic. More recently, within the last 15 years, the dwarf black-bellied salamander was described out of Quadrimaculatus, which is found in Georgia and a couple populations in South Carolina. Morphologically, looks identical. Again, it's a black-bellied salamander, but genetically, as well as a few very subtle morphological characteristics distinguish those groups. But for convention, you know, if you know locality, has a black belly, it's going to be one of the two. So around here, we don't have to worry about that. We just have that single species. See, that's what they do in Georgia to get up their species count. They just find these little endemic populations and then elevate them to species. You can tell Carlos Camp I said that. Desmognathus marmoratus, the shovel-nosed salamander. Very unusual life history for a Desmognathian in the sense that it's permanently aquatic just about. Very rarely ever find this salamander on land. Quadrimaculatus, which it's closely related to and resembles, it's also very aquatic, but you'll find it out at night foraging. Quadrimaculatus will also climb trees, trunk trees to forage on crickets and moths and things like that. Whereas this species will almost entirely stay in the water. Behaviorally, it's been said, although I haven't really noticed this myself, that if you flip a rock with a black bill underneath it, the first thing it's going to do is scurry away, try to get away from you as fast as possible. You flip a rock with a shovel-nosed salamander underneath it, it's pretty much just going to sit there and stay put. I've not really noticed that. I've only seen a few of these in the field. But again, they're very aquatic, a little bit lower elevation than where quads are found. Quads can be found all throughout. But morphologically, they look very similar. Now, these images here, a little bit more pronounced. One of the key things to look for, and this is, again, kind of a generality, kind of difficult to see, is that if you look at the slope of this head, it's more of a spade or shovel-like appearance. The eyes are less bulbous than quadrimaculatus, the black-bellied salamander. You look at the venner, supposedly it has a little bit less of that black-bellied pigment. It can be grayish, but I've also seen specimens that are dark black. Internally, if you look at the internal nares, opening the nares, that's the key defining characteristic, which obviously is very difficult to do in the field with a live salamander. But black-bellied salamanders have round nares, whereas shovel-nosed salamanders have slit-like nares. Now, it's kind of a crappy characteristic to try to use in the field. I try to look at the slope of the head, look at habitat where they're found. To an extent, they're a little bit less robust, more streamlined, also have a more pronounced, almost like tail fin, very, very keeled tail because of their aquatic existence. Again, these are kind of subtle things to look at. In a recent paper from 2004 where they looked at some of the molecular genetics of shovel-nosed salamanders and black-bellied salamanders, what they found, a very interesting finding, is that rather than all black-bellied salamanders representing a single group, if you looked at within a single drainage, shovel-nosed salamanders and black-bellied salamanders within that drainage were each other's closest relatives rather than the other way around. So it appears to be maybe a repeated evolution to this aquatic type phenotype species. So they're closely related. The folks are still kind of working out that mess. Actually, one of Ben's students now is potentially looking at a project involving that. So we'll probably be several taxonomic revisions within the next 30 years on this group. So what we know is Marmoratus will probably be split into 7 or 8 different species. Okay, Coey salamanders. This belongs to a group of mountain dusky salamanders, which are definitely more terrestrial in nature than the previous species that we've looked at. One of the defining characteristics, which you can't see real well in this picture, is that they're going to have a round tail basically a round diameter tail at the base of the tail, whereas the other species had that distinct keel. Within a coey, though, there's some populations that show somewhat of a keel. Those in the Smoky Mountains that I've seen anyway don't really have that. It's kind of a gestalt thing with me when I look at them. They definitely look like they're more adept at climbing. Their limbs are a little bit longer, they're less robust, they're less stocky. They're also not going to grow to near large size. A coey salamander is going to be maybe this long with tail. So they're more just kind of a typical looking salamander. Coloration wise, if you read Dodd's book, Way to Distinguish This Species from it's very closely related species, the imitator salamander, which will have a dark phase. Imitators are going to have this big cheek spot, red-orange cheek spot. However, there are some areas of the park where that doesn't occur, where they actually have a dark phase and they don't have that cheek spot. Supposedly, if you look at the ground color and kind of the edges of the light coloration on the dorsum, this one obviously is a very dark individual. The ground color tends to be much darker. If you look at where that stripe potentially could be, it's very straight-edged in a coey. It's a characteristic that they use. Whereas an imitator, it's more irregular, might have more vibrant colors in there as well. Also, elevation-wise, a coey is found a little higher elevations than imitator. Imitator is more mid-level, starting at, I think they mention, 3,000 feet in the book. I've seen them as low as 2,100, though, in some parts of the park. So, but again, if they have that, if you see any salamander that has a big orange spot like that, It's either going to be Desmonasus imitator, the imitator salamander, or it's going to be Plethodon jordani, which I'll show here in a little bit, the red cheek salamander. The way that you can tell those apart, I've got a picture of both of those side by side here. This is a red cheek salamander. This is an imitator salamander. Again, they both have that red spot. But if you look at the shape of the head, you can look at the margin of the jaw. It's more sinuate in Desmonathus, more straight-edged in jordani, but the large jaw muscle here, which is lacking. Also, key in on those hind limbs. You see the large hind limbs, that's going to be Desmonathus. If they're relatively the same size as the forelimbs, that's going to be Plethodon, okay, jordani. And again, imitator, you can see from this distribution here, essentially Smoky Mountain area over towards Asheville, so very close to home. Pygmy salamander, Desmonathus ridei, completely terrestrial. What's unique about this species, also Desmonathus aeneas, is that it undergoes direct development, so it doesn't have that typical biphasic life cycle that most stream salamanders have. So rather than having an aquatic larva, it actually bypasses that stage within the egg. So they hatch out as basically miniature looking adults. So pretty unique. This species is also found the furthest away from water. Still gonna be in moist environments, underneath moist logs, things like that. You typically find them in rocks. They have a much smaller size, and kind of the key things to look for, again, you see the light stripes, so you know it's Desmonathus. But the chevron, kind of black chevron shape pattern running down the dorsum. Okay, that's a key thing to hone in on. And also size-wise, as the name pygmy suggests, it's going to be a much smaller salamander. And you can see its distribution basically running the Blue Ridge. Okay. So one species that's pretty common that Dr. DeGray doesn't have on the list necessarily, but I thought I'd include it, just you guys will probably come across it, particularly at low elevations, is the slimy salamander. Very widespread group. So historically, what's been broken up into several species before Dick Hyten's work was all considered a single single species that varied in overall coloration, and particularly with the coloration and extent of these whitish flecks that you see. So in our area, we have just a single northern slimy salamander, although in West Tennessee, when you get past the Mississippi River, supposedly you're in the territory of the Mississippi slimy salamander. Morphologically, they look the same. So it's all based a lot of times on on just genetic divergence between the two groups. Morphologically, the same type of color pattern. Definitely, Plethodon is a very conserved genus in overall body shape. They can get quite large. Roughly 6-7 inches, pretty big adult. And as the name suggests, slimy salamander, they do produce copious amounts of this very slimy, sticky secretion from these granular glands, particularly concentrated on the tail. If you've never picked one of these guys up, if you've seen one in the field, definitely do so, because this stuff is like super glue. If you get it on, so you can imagine a predator raccoon trying to bite down on this animal by the tail. If it takes the tail off, gets that in its mouth, it's kind of noxious, it's very sticky, congeals very fast, so it's kind of a deterrent for future predation. So it's a pretty unique adaptation. And all Plethodons kind of have that, but it's particularly prevalent in the slimy salamanders. So like all other Plethodons, they also exhibit direct development. They bypass that aquatic larval stage, so they're going to have terrestrial eggs, hatch out as miniature adults. And in the park, glutinosis, the northern slimy are going to be found primarily at lower elevations and are gradually replaced by a higher elevation form. If you read Dodd's book, he goes by Okunalefti. It's also known as Tehali, depending on which systematist you're talking to. But it looks very similar in appearance. It's the degree and coloration of the white flecking. So in northern slimies, it's the white flecking along the lateral surfaces here are much more pronounced and numerous. It might be even brassy in coloration in the Smokies, whereas in the higher elevation forms of the Okunalefti and Tehali, this white pigmentation is not near as pronounced, particularly in the dorsum. They typically lack it. It's a very reduced along the sides. That's one of the, sort of the key kind of diagnostic character in the field to look for. Again, they can be highly, highly variable. So without having molecular evidence to really confirm, it'd be very difficult to tell them apart sometimes. Red cheek salamander, Plethodon jordani. It's probably what Smoky Mountain salamander's most famous Smoky Mountain salamander, if you look at it. It's a high elevation form. Again, has that very distinct red cheek patch. So it looks like a slimy salamander without the white spots, but a very distinct red cheek patch. There are some populations where that red patch is not near as pronounced. But even as young individuals, you will see that red pigmentation will be present. Not near as vibrant as these couple of individuals. Once you get up to roughly about 3,000 feet and above, you really can find very dense populations of these. At Chimney Tops, where you guys will stop at if you've not been there before, I counted 87 on one trip on the rock outcrops at night. So they can be pretty dense. It's pretty amazing seeing them all out. They produce that kind of noxious secretion. It's not toxic, but it's very kind of nasty for a predator. Whereas the imitator salamander, which is a Batesian mimic of this species, is pretty much very edible for most predators like shrews and raccoons, birds, predators of that nature. I'll figure this thing out yet. Southern redback salamander, Plethodon serratus. As you can see by its distribution here, you have these very disjunct populations. Here in East Tennessee, basically starting at the north edge of the park, down into North Carolina, then into Georgia. There's also a set of populations in Missouri, another group here in Oklahoma and Arkansas, and then another group around the Kissatchee area in Louisiana. Genetically, you would think, just based on the distribution, that there might be some deeper divergence, some genetic variation between them, but they're actually very, very closely related. So it appears that this is just a result of climatic shifter in the Pleistocene. Probably they've been isolating them at a whole lot of time to diverge. As you can see, it's general appearance. Plethodon lacks many of those big, large jaw muscles. As you can see, a very kind of round tail. These won't get near as large as slimy salamanders, maybe 2-3 inches, 4 inches max. Key thing, very distinct red coloration, straight edged all the way down, running onto the tail. In the park, you really can't misidentify this species with anything else. Other parts of the range where you can run into contact with the zigzag salamanders, then you have to look at waviness of this stripe. So in the redbacks, it's going to be straight. Zigzags, as the name would imply, it's going to be wavy or zigzagged on down. And again, that can be difficult sometimes, depending on the population. This also comes in a what's known as like a leadback or dark phase, where this red pigmentation is kind of obscured by a lot of melanophores, so it darkened individual, so you lack a lot of real vibrant color. But again, it's kind of the general Plethodon appearance that you see, red stripe. And you can find them from pretty high elevations all the way down to base level in the park. There we go. Blue Ridge T-line salamander, Eurasia wilderae. Anyone ever seen this species before or seen a T-line salamander in the field anywhere? Pretty common streamside salamander. Some can be kind of drab, colored like this, kind of greenish yellow, to some that are very bright orange, yellowish, even almost reddish in coloration. Key diagnostic feature though, is to look for these kind of longitudinal black stripes around the length of the body onto the tail. They're going to be 4 to 5 inches max total length. Have a very long, slender tail, as you can see here. Obviously, unless predators come along and broken it off. What's unique about Eurasia, not in this whole complex, is that males will develop these kind of fleshy projections on their snout and a cirri, as you can kind of see in this male here. Okay, which they obviously use in courtship. distribute pheromones. They'll also develop a very conspicuous mental gland, which will be like a round circular disc underneath the jaw right here. Females usually are much drabber in color. What we have in the Blue Ridge up through here, it's been considered historically as the Blue Ridge two-line salamander. Recent molecular work by King Kozak has shown that there's several cryptic lineages throughout this whole complex. This whole complex includes northern two-line salamanders, southern two-line salamanders, Genaluska salamander, which is found in the park, and this species. And what we actually know is Eurycia wilderae, rather than having this distribution here, it really runs Smoky Mountains on eastward towards the Cumberland Plateau and southern areas, like through Chattanooga, basically here on south towards Chattanooga, then over into the Cumberland Plateau. And the diversity appears to correlate well with old paleo drainages, so before the Pleistocene and Pliocene. So they're very morphologically conserved, but yet show a lot of cryptic diversity. So one of the next tests and steps to take will be to test kind of reproductive isolation. What's nice about this group is you can distinguish between males and females very easily by the presence of that gland. You know when they're going to be reproductively active. You can bring them into the lab and then try these courtship trials. Some of the other groups of salamanders, very difficult. As a group that I work with, Geranophilus, they don't exhibit any sexual dimorphism at all. Very difficult to tell males from females, so those experiments are not near as successful. Okay, so we got a couple pictures that didn't show up, but we got one that did, the red salamander. This is what happens when you go from Mac to Windows for PowerPoint. You go from Windows to Mac, no problem. Mac to Windows, problem. Thank you, Bill Gates. So anyway, red salamander, I'm sure you probably have seen this one in the field. As its name implies, it's red. A lot of small black spots or flecks that run along the dorsum. Similar in appearance to spring salamanders, which I'll show here in a little bit. But they're very robust, stocky, fairly aquatic, stream edge. You can also find them in the stream. They have a long larval period, so again, we're back biphasic life cycle. They're going to lay their eggs. As you can see here, this is an image of a female actually ovipositing an egg in a cave. But they usually lay their eggs deep in stream beds, undergrounds and springs, or in caves. Those eggs are going to take 2 to 3 months to develop, and then they have a larval period ranging 2 to 3 years, so pretty long. Desmonathus, we talked about earlier, their larval period might run anywhere a couple months, 6, 7, 8 months, maybe a year for like Eurycia typically lasts between 6 to 12 months, depending on the species that you're looking at. So again, a very long larval period. And I had some pictures of those. Since they didn't show up, I'll send Dr. Gray so you can post them on the site or do a Google search. But I'm sure you guys have seen red salamanders before. Pretty obvious to tell. Spring salamanders, Geranophilus porphyriticus, is one of the groups that I work with. What we have in the park is all Blue Ridge spring salamanders, which have a very distinct feature on the snout that you can distinguish them from red salamanders. They have this what's known as a canthus rostralis that runs from the eye to the margin of the snout on both sides, which has been hypothesized to be used as almost like a gun sight to lock in on prey. I don't know if I necessarily buy it. This is kind of variable between some of the other subspecies. And also the fact that this species can be found in caves in complete darkness quite frequently. So they're obviously relying on other mechanisms to locate prey than simply vision. So it might be related to courtship or pheromone detection, something like that. Who knows? But in the park, they're infrequently found throughout highest elevations all the way to lowest elevations. They all will have this very bright orange coloration, or might be reddish. Small black flecking, not near to the extent that red salamanders might have. Key thing to look for, again, is that canthus rostralis to tell them apart, again, that stocky body appearance. As larvae, they can get quite large. Individuals in the higher elevations will metamorphose at smaller sizes than those lower elevations, but some of the cave populations that we have here in the Valley and Ridge can get upwards of almost 7 to 8 inches before they actually go through metamorphosis. So based on some of the data that we have, it's generally assumed they take 3 to 4 years in literature to undergo metamorphosis, which is a pretty long time. We've got growth estimates that the larvae grow in caves anyway, maybe a centimeter snout vent length a year. And so they're transforming at roughly about 100 millimeter snout vent length. So that would suggest maybe upwards of 10 years is how long they take to reach metamorphosis. And then they might take a year or two even to reach sexual maturity after that. So some of these individuals can be probably quite old.
Matt, with respect to the other plethodontids you talked about, how long on average are we talking about to reach sexual
maturity? So usually within a year after metamorphosis for a lot of these species, pseudotride might take 1 to 2 years. But for the Eurasia, they're pretty quick growing. Once they undergo metamorphosis, they might take a year to reach sexual maturity. Males probably reach sexual maturity quicker than the females do. Desmonathus, going to take a little bit longer because they transform at a much smaller size. So it might take them 2 years, just depending on food availability and how quick they can grow. So that kind of is kind of the list of species that are common in the park that you might have a good chance of finding on your field trips. Hopefully the weather will cooperate and it'll be raining, about 50 degrees, and so stuff will be out moving everywhere. It's kind of been rough. The last 2 years has been so damn dry that you go up there sometimes, and the same rock faces that I've seen 87 plethodon jordani, you go there and you can't even find a millipede crawling around. That's how dry it's been. So now that we're finally getting some rain, it should be pretty nice. Now I'm just going to talk about a few other species that you can find in the park. We did it on time. You guys usually take a break?
Or about six.
About six, okay, so we got about 15 minutes. I'll try not to go too fast. The cave salamander, not to be confused with the Tennessee cave salamander, which I'll talk about here in a little bit. But this is a very common species found throughout basically anywhere within the interior lowlands and Appalachian Valley where there's exposed limestone. Okay, as the name implies, they're typically found in caves, very common habitat. Although they're also very common at the surface, so don't let that common name kind of fool you. Particularly in middle Tennessee, you can find them out on the cedar glades. Wet, rainy nights, they'll come up to the surface to forage, to also disperse. So you can find them on roads if you ever do any road cruising. It's pretty neat to see. Again, typical larval phase. This is actually one that's nearing metamorphosis there. Way that I can kind of distinguish them from other species in their larval stages, they have a very short, blunt snout, very large eyes in proportion to their head. Cave salamanders, as they get larger, will start to develop their black spotting, and they'll go from this, they'll almost go from a jet black color as a small hatchling, slowly become grayish, get more yellow pigment, more orange pigment, until they finally get their adult coloration right at metamorphosis. Okay, and you can tell from this image here, I don't know how well you can see it, but these are the gills, they're starting to be reabsorbed. Again, very common. They also will develop the cirri, like the two-line salamanders in males, and also the distinct mental glands, so you can tell males and females apart very easily. They typically breed, October, November is when eggs are laid. And the females, what's kind of unusual is that they'll lay their eggs in just rimstone pools or small pools, and they'll scatter them. So most species of plethodontids will actually exhibit some sort of parental care. The females will actually stay with the eggs until hatching, and then the hatchling's basically on their own. Cave salamanders have a different strategy. Rather than putting all their eggs in one basket and protecting it, so to speak, they scatter them. So the female will lay 4 or 5 eggs in this little pool. She'll then crawl around, find another one, deposit a few more here. And so it's very typical to be in a cave walking around, and we're particularly in caves in Knox County, which are very, very muddy, and you can leave muddy, water-filled footprints. You can see eggs and larvae in there. And they'll be found off throughout. So they're highly mobile species. That's why they're found off throughout these karst areas. So basically anywhere with exposed limestone, they're able to work their way through. Very successful species. Long-tailed salamanders, close related to the cave salamanders, Xerecia longicauda. As the name would imply, they have a very, very long, distinct tail, which I don't have a good image of. You see in this metamorph, the tail length is usually greater than the length from the vent, or essentially the cloaca, to the tip of the snout. As adults, what they'll develop on the tail are these distinct chevrons along the sides. It's the easiest way to tell them apart from cave salamanders. Usually yellowish in coloration. Those in East Tennessee I found to be a little more vibrant in color than those in Middle and West Tennessee. As you can see from the range here, we're really close to this kind of intergrade zone between the two subspecies, the long-tailed salamander and the dark-sided salamander. Dark-sided salamander, actually over here, excuse me, I meant to say three-line salamander, which is historically treated as a subspecies, was elevated to species, but as that name would imply, it actually ends up having two distinct lines, like a two-line, and then pigment kind of coalesces along the midline of the dorsum and forms a third stripe. Now you get down a little bit south of Chattanooga, supposedly you run into three-line salamanders. I've done quite a bit of caving and collection in northwest Georgia, basically right in through this area. I've always come across long tails, so I guess there's still some variation there. You definitely get down in the coastal plain, down in Florida, southern Georgia, run into three-line salamanders. And supposedly, this extends on into the coastal plain here in West Tennessee. Again, I've done most of my work around the Rillfoot area, which is up here in northwest Tennessee, and I've seen long tails, haven't seen the three-line. Floyd Scott at APSU's told me along the Tennessee River, getting up towards land between the lakes, they apparently integrate there, or so he thinks. Okay, Gerinophilus pelucus. This one's dear to my heart since I did 3 years of my master's on this guy. The Tennessee cave salamander. You see a lot of variation there in coloration. Historically, it's only known from maybe 20 locations throughout the state. There were three subspecies recognized. There's the pale salamander, which is Gerinophilus pelucus pelucus, which is this guy down here. So, again, very pale body form. What's unique about all of the Tennessee cave salamanders is rather than going through metamorphosis, they have a different life strategy where they do not transform. They remain sexually mature as larvae, essentially, a condition known as pedomorphosis. Okay, so all these individuals here are sexually mature. But again, you can see the gills, which is a larval condition. They also have a very well-developed lateral line system, which is typically lost in most plethodontid salamander larvae when they go through metamorphosis. And they also have a very distinct tail fin. So you can see the lateralis system here on the head in this image, a series of like white spots, basically pits that have exposed mechanoreceptors to detect vibrations in the water. So they're found in caves, almost never found at the surface. Only a couple have been collected that have been washed out of springs. Almost never undergo metamorphosis, although a few have been found in the wild that have gone through that condition. Those that have been found don't look anything like spring salamanders, which they're closely related to. Their eyes don't fully develop. They don't become near as bulbous. Their head morphology is quite different. So as you can see, they've got very, very small eyes. This varies between caves, even in the same watershed. Some are going to be larger, some are very small. A couple of cave populations we found, flesh almost completely covers the eye, so it almost looks like a pinprick. There's a lot of variation there. You can also see tons of variation in their coloration. Some have a very distinct spotting, some might be in blotches, some have that pale colors, but none are true albinos. That's kind of a misnomer. You look at the Peterson Field Guide and the line drawing for Tennessee cave salamanders, it makes it look like it's an albino and ghostly looking thing. Obviously, you can tell they're quite pigmented. So they've not been underground, been living in caves for that long a period of time, maybe a couple million years based on what my master's work kind of indicates. But you can see the general range here. So if not located here, they're found primarily in the karst regions of Middle Tennessee, down along the Tennessee River there in Georgia. The species that we have up here, which historically was treated as a subspecies, is Gerinophilus coulineatus, the very cave salamander. You can actually find them in a cave within a mile and a half from where we're standing right now, which is kind of unique. So that's one of only seven known localities. Put that in perspective. Coulineatus has been a candidate for federal listing. I'm sure you guys are well aware of the politics right now. Nothing's been listed in the last 5 years, if not longer, I think. It's been quite a long period of time. I've done some surveys at some local caves, and they're probably more common than what that data kind of indicates, being done from seven localities. The problem is the caves in which they inhabit are much different than the caves in Middle Tennessee. The caves in Middle Tennessee are kind of developed in these horizontal bedded limestones, so they can be very expansive. You can think of like Mammoth Cave, all these connected corridors, and it's much like that. Whereas the caves here in the valley and ridge, since we have that faulting and you have these big ridges that develop, and then the caves are going to be located in the valleys where the limestone is at, they all run down at angles. There are all these little small dud holes that fill with clay and mud, and so you can't go very far to explore the groundwater. And so they're probably distributed more widely. We just don't have access to where they're living. So that's partly the reason. They also do, though, have a very restricted distribution. Looks like located primarily along the Tennessee River. There's a single record down here in McMinn County, which was initially described, when it's described as a subspecies. They found three individuals in a flooded ditch. So after a really major spring rain, they collected three individuals that were definitely buried cave salamanders. And when the water receded, they went back and looked, and there was a small hole that they came out of. The unique thing was there isn't a cave located, at least to our knowledge, within 5 miles of that site. So obviously there's subterranean passages that they're able to disperse through that we just don't have access to.
Matt, if folks are interested in going along with you in the field, how do you go out very frequently?
So Ben and I actually have a project right now. One thing that I didn't mention for the sake of time, I guess take a break right after this, is that there appears to be hybridization going on between buried cave salamanders and spring salamanders here in Knox County at a couple of localities where they're quite frequent. So you can actually see kind of a transition from larvae and adults and metamorphosed adults near the entrances that look like spring salamanders. As you work your way back, you kind of see these individuals that look in between. They don't look quite right, particularly if they transform. We found a few individuals that are metamorphosing early, and they have very odd looking skull morphologies that we're going to do some morphometrics on. You get deeper into the cave, furthest away from the entrance, you get into what look to be pure buried cave salamanders. So we're kind of examining this gradient from a genetic perspective, but also doing a lot of marker capture work. We actually have a collaboration with the Knoxville Zoo now to try to develop a captive breeding program. Not so much from a conservation perspective from our angle, although it would be great if we can figure out exactly how they reproduce in the larval state, since that's never been witnessed in any cave salamanders, except for Eurasia rathbuni, Texas blind salamander. Knoxville Zoo is able to figure that out and get that working, that opens up a whole domain of analyses that we can do to test hypotheses regarding how certain characters evolve, or like the eyes, how they degenerate in cave animals. So that's kind of the angle that we're looking at. But we're also doing lots of natural history work, diet analyses, marker capture work for the state. So yes, if anyone is interested in getting dirty, the downside with caves around Knoxville is that they are super, 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 super muddy. I've got extra cave gear, so you wouldn't need anything other than a change of clothes and some clothes that you wouldn't hurt you to throw away maybe when you're out of the cave, or bad pair of shoes. But yeah, if you ever want to get underground, if you've never done it, I can take you to a couple easier caves, get you experienced. And if you like it, yeah, free help always is great. What tends to happen is folks go out with me a couple of times and I don't ever see them again. So it wouldn't hurt my feelings if that happened as well. So if you are interested in seeing the salamanders and seeing some other cave life, I also do a lot of work in Middle Tennessee too on cave fish. So if you're interested in tag along for a trip, I'd be more than happy to take you out if there's space, show you some neat animals.
I'll put Matt's contact information on the website if you guys are interested in volunteering for extra credit. Go along and experience some new things.
Yeah, we also have some other projects going on too, not just cave stuff. I'll talk about when we do a couple of the other salamanders. So I do a lot of other herp work, so I'm not a complete spelunker yet. So take a short break.
Take a 5 minute break, y'all.
yeah, you can honestly talk a long time about all these species.
Oh, yeah.
So what do you guys transform if you bring them up?
So, old studies that were done in the 60s from some of the collections in Middle Tennessee, they were actually induced with thyroxine and iodine to get into metamorphose artificially. I've collected several individuals. I've got a couple that are in my fridge right now. I keep them at like 42 degrees or whatnot. And I've had them for several months to see if that would happen, and they don't. So I think it takes a good amount of stress to get that to occur, but we've collected we've seen six individuals from Mead Quarry Cave that we're still trying to figure out if they represent potentially a hybrid sort or an actually metamorphosed Berry Cave salamander. Mm-hmm. I've got one alive. Actually, I can pull it up real fast. Off the break, come back to the slide.
How similar does Berry Cave salamanders look to Tennessee Cave?
They're real similar. It's the ground color, relative eye size. There's differences in vertebrae number. They're very, it's subtle. Yeah. So you have internet access here, right? Open up a new one. I'll show you some wild pictures real quick. So if that's a metamorphosed Geranalphus pallucus pallucus.
Wow.
So if you look at that side by side with a spring salamander here, so the eyes, they start to develop. They develop a noticeable iris, but they don't get near as bulbous. You can also see in relative head shape how much longer and narrower the snout is. Yeah. If you look at the hybrids, what we think are the hybrids from Knox County, they almost look in between this, so the snout is not near as long. It's almost looks like a hexagon coming out, and then it goes out back like this towards the rest of the body. It's very, very bizarre, and the eyes don't get even near as large as this. And what's really weird, I mean, this was a female. She had eggs, so I collected her in hopes that maybe she would lay in the lab, and we could get some hatchlings, which would be just absolutely awesome. She reabsorbed them, so I thought she was going to die. Put her in an aquarium. I had her for about a month and a half in the fridge. Nothing was happening. She wouldn't eat. I tried to put worms in, amphipods, other things she wouldn't eat. So I stuck her in my aquarium I have with a couple spring salamanders and a seal salamander just to see what she'd do. And I've had her for over a year now. She's re-yoking up again, so I've never actually witnessed her feed, but apparently she does. I drop in crickets and worms and they disappear. So I'm assuming that she does, but very, very bizarre. And the odd thing is the individuals that we've collected from Mead Quarry Cave that were transformed, I can't keep alive more than 3 weeks. They all look very, very sickly, malnourished, you know, very emaciated, won't feed. They last about 3 weeks, even in the fridge when I keep them cold, and then they die. So it's very, very odd. We've got an idea of what might be going on, what's causing some of that. So it might be some mixed ancestry. It's a partial explanation, but at Mead Quarry, what is kind of happening is in a couple areas of the cave system, some lye is leaching in from the old quarry operations in very, very high concentrations where we're talking very, very alkaline water. And it's right at that input area where we see the highest concentrations of metamorphosed individuals. So the way we first found out it was bad was we found our first individual. We could take it back to the lab, you know, got the water out of the pool, put the animal in it, you know, got back to the lab, opened it up, salamander's dead. And we're like, oh my God. Tested the pH of the water and it was just like, holy crap. It's like my hand was in that. So pretty crazy.
So yeah. Natural stressor.
I thought that I had this identified, but I'm not 100% sure. I figured you'd probably be the one to ask. Is that a cave?
Yep.
Okay.
Where'd you find them at?
There's a cave on the back side of Ion's Nature Center. I think it used to be a rock quarry or something, but there's like a natural cave too connected to it.
Yeah, that's where our study sites are at.
Oh, yeah?
On the back side across railroad tracks.
Uh-huh.
Yep.
Looks like you're not supposed to go in there.
That's the Mead Quarry system.
pretty nice.
Yeah, so if you get down in the stream, you can occasionally, probably the cave you went into is Meat River. So is it like, was it a slit?
Yeah.
You hop in and you hit a stream and you can go downstream.
Yeah, like we went all the way through it as far as we could, and like on the other side there's a thick braided cord, like a steel cable.
Oh, so that is Mead. That is Mead Quarry.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you can actually go upstream from there. The main entrance in the quarry hole that has the car.
Yeah,
you seen that one?
We started there, and
so you start there, and then you guys went downstream, looped around, came up the cable.
Come out and look.
So if you actually go the other direction there, you can walk. You have to get wet, for sure. You can go almost 4,000 feet. So.
Wow. Yeah, I was afraid walking through the water might come up and get
me. Yeah, that's the same water where this lie input's coming in. Ah, crap. Get started? Is there one here? Okay, talk a little bit about Yanalasi salamanders next. Obviously, based on that picture there, which isn't mine, unfortunately, I've not been able to get good shots of Yanalasis. I think a very colorful and charismatic looking salamander. Related to the slimy salamanders, it's large plethodontid. You take away this red pigmentation, you think it looked like a slimy salamander. Obviously, the diagnostic feature there is almost like looks like it was painted with a paintbrush, that dark red coloration. Can be almost, can get dark purple in older individuals. But as you see in their distribution here, primarily found from North Carolina, gets up into very extreme east, northeast Tennessee, over into southern Virginia. Pete Wyatt's done quite a bit of work looking at the distribution of this group in Tennessee. I think he's found a few new populations and a new watershed up there. I'm not that familiar with it. I've done very limited work up in extreme East Tennessee, which is pretty bad. It's actually a kind of a unique area where several species of salamander that we don't find anywhere else in Tennessee are located there. But again, very photogenic looking salamander. Another salamander that has that red pigmentation that's found in this general area is the Pigeon Mountain salamander, Plethodon petraeus, in northwest Georgia. Found just from Pigeon Mountain and a few localities there. Again, has that similar type of appearance. Looks like a large slimy salamander with kind of reddish or orangish pigmentation on the dorsum. The hellbender. Has anyone ever seen the hellbender in here? They're pretty neat, aren't they? One of my favorite salamanders. Unfortunately, throughout most of their range, it appears they're declining in numbers. Partly because of habitat destruction or alteration, but in some areas where conditions still appear to be very pristine, populations are declining. So as you can see, kind of a grotesque looking salamander. I don't really think so, but it's kind of how it's described. Obviously by the name hellbender, kind of invokes some sort of fear. Obviously lots of stories of fishermen catching these and not knowing what the heck it is. You can see that very wrinkly skin. Doesn't have external gills like other aquatic salamanders. It actually is pedomorphic, so it actually does retain the gills underneath the flaps. But what they do have specialization is very increased folding of their skin, so they're absorbing oxygen primarily through their skin rather than with the gills. Also, you can tell from this photo, very large cornified toe tips. So they're found in swift water typically to help them crawl along the bottom, get underneath rocks. Very large, flattened dorsal ventrally head, and also very, very tiny eyes. They're nocturnal in nature, feed primarily on crayfish, and get quite large. They're our, by weight, largest salamander that we have in North America. So they can get upwards, I think the record's around 28 inches. So a pretty large individual. And if you ask my old advisor, Brian Miller, apparently they give a very painful bite. Typically, don't ever bite when they're caught. he was actually, I think, trying to put a transmitter in the gullet. It was starting to come back out, so he went to push it back in. At that point, the salamander clamped down and did a death roll like an alligator and basically cut all the flesh all the way down to the bone, and he had to get stitches. So this is what I hear. So don't shove anything down in a hellbender's mouth unless you want to bite.
Hey, you want to hit that? I'll talk about this species, and let's look at that video of hellbenders.
Okay. So the next one, a mud puppy, actually a very common species up north. I don't think they're near as common here in Tennessee. I've only seen a handful of individuals throughout. Originally from Indiana, so we'd catch them all the time, you know, call them water dogs, use them as bait, which is kind of bad. Down here they call them spring lizards a lot of times. I've seen local fishermen walking along creeks next to reservoirs collecting streamside salamanders for bait, which is kind of sucks, but that's what they do down here.
It's not illegal.
It's, well,
as long as you use them within the same watershed.
Even in Tennessee?
In Tennessee, yeah.
See, Georgia, you can collect anything, just as long as it's not a state-listed species. We could go down there right now and collect anything we wanted, keep it as a pet, be no big deal. Tennessee has much stricter laws.
You can collect salamanders and use them for fishing within the same watershed.
Okay. Yeah, I'll just say I'm fishing from now on.
Yeah.
Avoid my scientific collection permit.
Yeah.
Yeah. But these guys, another real large salamander, permanently aquatic. They're obligate pedomorphs. Again, you can see these large fluffy gills. Used to be very common for dissections and learning about anatomy. I guess in some parts of the country they still are, but not when I was taking any biology classes growing up. What's kind of neat as youngsters, so this individual is maybe 3 or 4 inches long. As juveniles, they have, they're really dark in coloration, but have these kind of olivish yellow to green stripes running along the length of the body, which eventually go away as they age. They can get, typically on average, 10, 13 inches in length, a very robust salamander. More common in kind of still standing water. Not necessarily in swamps, but in large pools and rivers and things like that, rather than in riffle areas. In the Great Lakes, they can apparently be in quite dense numbers, come up in traps quite a bit. So, pretty neat looking salamander. So, I guess next, take a quick look at a couple of videos we wanted to show you. I'm sure you guys are familiar with Tennessee Wildside. You ever seen that television show? The first is going to be a quick little blurb about hellbenders, and then I'll also show you one on Tennessee cave salamanders.
I'll send you the links to these videos if you guys are interested, or at least to Tennessee Wildside website.
Their site sometimes has issues, particularly in the last 3 or 4 days.
Oh, nice.
Maybe we won't watch it right now.
Maybe we won't watch it. I can, I'll forward you the site so you guys can take a look at it if this doesn't pop up here. We brought it up earlier. Yeah, it looks like something's working kind of slow right now on their website. Yeah, it isn't even bringing their website up now. That's weird.
Okay. The only reason we can see it here is it's already been downloaded. Maybe we'll try it towards the end of class. Okay.
Okay, now I'll get into the ambistomatic salamanders, the mole salamanders, which are a pretty neat group. The first being the tiger salamander. These are all very large-bodied terrestrial salamanders as adults, usually fossorial in nature, so they're going to spend most of their time underground in rodent burrows, crayfish burrows as well. Sometimes we'll dig their own in loose soil. Again, have that very standard biphasic life cycle. They're going to migrate to typically breeding ponds, vernal ponds, during this time of year. So if we get a nice big rain for the next 2 weeks or so, I guarantee tiger salamanders will probably be on the move if they're not there already with some of the rains that we've had. But they'll make these long migrations, sometimes upwards of a kilometer to a breeding pond. Typically males are going to arrive there first. Females will follow usually a couple of weeks later with another rain event. This is usually always triggered by temperature and also rainfall. Enter the pond, they'll breed. The males will actually drop down a spermatophore, so they have external fertilization. Drop down the spermatophore, the female will come over, she'll pick it up, then we'll go into the pond and lay her eggs, and might lay her eggs in a variety of habitats depending on the species. So I've got a few images to show. Tiger salamanders, as their names imply, are very voracious. They'll eat just about anything. They're great as pets. I've got five at home that are actually hybrids or bens, crosses, F1 hybrids between California tiger salamanders, which are federally endangered, and the invasive blotched tiger salamander, or a barred tiger salamander that they have out there. So he's done a lot of, my advisor, current advisor now, has done a lot of work looking at the effects of hybridization between those two species. So he has a lot of lab-raised individuals. So the greatest pets, I highly recommend them. All you have to do is feed them once every 2-3 weeks. Dump in a bunch of crickets and watch them go to town. And they'll eat until they just about explode, so. Pretty good as pets, but obviously very large and robust, kind of a mottling, blotchy appearance, typically yellow in color. Different subspecies are gonna vary in the degree of that pigmentation and also amount of coloration on the head and subtle changes in eye size and head morphology. Here in Tennessee, again, we just have the one species, the eastern tiger salamander, which depicted in this range map, kind of sporadic, found throughout the Tennessee River Valley into the Central Basin and on northward. That's probably more an artifact of lack of collection. There's a lot of areas in Tennessee that herpetologists have not hit very hard at all, particularly kind of the areas that they show on this map. So southwest Tennessee, get away from Memphis. No one has really collected a whole lot there. We don't know a whole lot about the herpetofauna. Same way as portions of the Cumberland Plateau. We know a lot about some of the salamander species, the Plethodon salamander species, but as you get in higher elevations, the densities of the ambistomatids definitely drop off, and so you kind of find sporadic records here or there. But very common, they still do well around urbanization. You can still find them in Middle Tennessee around Murfreesboro. Just outside in the suburbs, you can find them, you know, on your lawn. They're real friendly. They get into flower beds and things like that to kind of burrow. The mole salamander, Bistoma talpoidium. This is a species deemed in need of management by TWRA. Again, you look at its distribution here in Tennessee, very sporadic. Found primarily in two distinct areas along the eastern Highland Rim. In the Barrens area, and then out in West Tennessee in the coastal plain. There are records from around here. I've actually found them in the park. If you go around Cades Cove, a couple of the swampy areas there, you can find them. Found a couple of individuals. They're not very dense, but they're not really dense anywhere they're found. So not near as abundant as the spotted salamanders and marble salamanders they coexist with. A way that you can tell them apart from other species is they typically have a very, seen this individual, a very keeled tail, very short, robust, very stocky, and their head almost comes to a point in some cases, very flat, almost spade-like. so hence a mole for digging. So this one's actually from the Realfoot Lake area, real bluish in coloration. Some, they're typically more grayish, kind of that grayish modeling that you see. One of the best ways to find this species, again, is go out wet, rainy nights. If you can drive the roads, great. If not, find swampy areas and flip logs around water, or if you can put on a pair of waders and dip net. One of the populations that we studied quite a bit in Middle Tennessee, they will actually enter the pond in November if the water is available, and will stay in there upwards of like 6 months. We'll be feeding underwater. So they're not like larval salamanders, obviously. As adults, they will feed underwater. And this is also one of the species that's known to have pedomorphic populations. Tiger salamanders also can be pedomorphic. Spotted salamanders, obviously, as the name implies, you see those very distinct yellowish to orangish spots that run in pairs, typically along the length of the body. Again, get very large, robust size. This is a large gravid female we found in the Middle Tennessee. Again, they're like tiger salamanders. They will basically flock in droves to breeding ponds when the right conditions are met, under the spring rains. And it can be pretty amazing, the abundance of some of these salamanders. Brian Miller did quite a bit of work at Arnold Air Force Base and had pitfall traps and drift fences lined around a couple of ponds. And a couple of occasions, he collected upwards of 600 to 700 individuals of spotted salamanders in a single night. So all moving this one, less than, I think it was maybe a third of an acre total surface area of the pond they were able to breed in. So it can be very, very abundant. Again, relying on ephemeral wetlands to fill up, which they will go in and lay their eggs, typically in a very, that's supposed to be the picture down there that didn't show up, very large gelatinous egg mass, very, very conspicuous. Sometimes they'll be almost as large as your hand. They're going to swell with water. But there you can see a picture of a female ovipositing, so she's starting to lay her eggs. So they will swim and swim throughout, find a suitable area, typically on sticks or some sort of hard structure, and she'll lay her egg mass, or sometimes will lay two or three and scatter them. And unfortunately, what happens a lot of times is that when she lays her eggs, if we didn't get enough rainfall, the water level drops, or if we get a cold snap, those eggs are going to freeze and then die. Or just dry out. But if they are able to persist, what a lot of times happens is you'll see a kind of a greenish appearance to that egg mass, and so a symbiotic algae actually develops within, I think it was within the egg itself, or the egg membrane. I've got to remember my biology about them. It's been a while. So kind of unique. But you see their distribution, very widespread, ranging all the way up into Canada, all the way down to the Gulf Coast. The streamside salamander, I threw this one in here. It's because it's probably the most imperiled species of salamander we have in the state. It's only located, see here, even on this map, they don't even depict the populations of Middle Tennessee. Here's represented by a couple county records, but from what we know right now, it's only known from four streams just south of Murfreesboro, and it's probably severely impacted by agriculture and expanding metropolitan Murfreesboro. For those of you not familiar with Middle Tennessee, Rutherford County is one of the, at least within the last 5 years, is one of the largest growing counties in the nation population-wise. There's been a lot of urban sprawl, definitely southward from town into the area where the species is found. So it's found in this very narrow strip of suitable streams. Historically, it was probably found throughout a much greater area in the Central Basin. There's records from just south of Nashville, around Donaldson, as well as a record from Jackson County, getting upwards towards the Kentucky-Tennessee state line back in the 60s. We've not been able to, the Donaldson area record, we know exactly where that was at. It's now a parking lot, so they're no longer found there. There's still maybe some hope for the Jackson County areas, but we recently did a survey a couple of years ago of about 50 area streams around there. We only found them, again, in those four historic sites, and actually there used to be seven historic sites, and we only found extant populations in four. Brian now has a grant with TWRA to do mercury capture work and also genetic work, because it turns out you can see this disjunct distribution from the core center of the species range. There's some morphological as well as genetic evidence that this probably is a distinct lineage and warrants species recognition. So that being the case, it'd be probably one of the rarest salamanders in the U.S. See, what's kind of unusual about them, whereas most of the ambistomatids will lay their eggs in ponds, so the name implies streamside salamanders, they prefer actual flowing water, flowing streams, where they'll lay their eggs in a monolayer on the undersurface of rocks, as you can see in this picture, and in large numbers. So I think there's actually over 300 eggs under that rock. And so typical type of strategy, though, males are going to migrate to the stream edge first. Females will follow a couple weeks later, second rain event. She'll then oviposit her eggs beneath the rocks. They'll then move back into the surrounding countryside or forest, where they spend most of their adult life, you know, underground.
Does she pick up a spermatophore also?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
You know, Matt's talking a lot about reproductive strategies and development strategies, direct development, biphasic life cycles, pedomorphism, things like that. Those are all new things. We've just started the course, but we're going to have several lectures on reproductive strategies, development strategies, etc. So we'll go over all of these things, okay? Talk about how amphibians develop from basically an egg to ultimately an adult.
Yeah, so don't let me scare you. You don't need to know that for identification. But I have to throw in a little bit of extra material. Marbled salamanders, another one of my favorite species to find. Can be very, very abundant throughout the eastern U.S., definitely here in Tennessee. Again, they're going to be breeding in streams, but they kind of have an unusual strategy. As you can see, get the name marbled salamander from their kind of alternating black and white stripe, the blotchiness characteristic of this species. Not going to have a problem misidentifying this when you find it. But what the females actually will do is typically in September and October, they're going to migrate to these ephemeral wetlands before they even fill with water, okay? So they're going to migrate in, they're going to get underneath a log, some other sort of cover object, and then she'll actually deposit her eggs terrestrially and stay with them, as you can see in this picture here, in these developing embryos. She'll then wait for hopefully the rains to come, inundate the wetland, obviously inundating the eggs, which then triggers those eggs to hatch out, and then she'll leave the pond afterwards. Unfortunately, definitely in the last 3 years, I guarantee there's probably been zero recruitment for marbled salamanders here in East Tennessee and throughout much of Tennessee, just because we've just been so dry. Even this year, even with some of those rains we have, our water table was so low that I thought maybe some of the wetlands would fill, but they really haven't. And how are the wetlands over in the plateau that you guys work in?
Oh, man,
they're still down. Yeah, so unfortunately, zero recruitment the last few years. And that being said, you can probably kind of already hypothesize that they're going to be a long-lived species. They're actually fairly quick to reach metamorphosis, maybe lasting 2 to 3 months. But as adults, they might live 10, 15, 20 years. We don't really know for some species. I know there's a record of spotted salamanders in captivity living for 28 years. So just basically as old as me. It's pretty amazing to think about that. And like the cave forms are some evidence that they might be 20, 30 years old, easy.
The only ambistomatid that frequently breeds in the fall, correct, for Tennessee?
That's right, yeah. So if we go kind of through a chronology of when different species of ambistomatid might breed, first is going to be the marbled salamander for sure, September, October, into November. Followed by in probably late December, early January, spotted salamanders, followed quickly past that by mole salamanders if they're found in the same areas, tiger salamanders, and one that I don't have pictures of tonight, but it's also found smallmouth salamanders, which are found out in West Tennessee, all around that month period. So, yeah, well before spring peepers or chorus frogs ever move into the pond, these guys are already there, kind of getting a head start. And it's kind of their reproductive strategy, particularly when the tiger salamanders get into the same type of pond, because tiger salamanders will grow very, very rapidly. They're very voracious. And if the larvae of the marbled salamander don't reach a large enough size to avoid predation and avoid obviously being eaten, then they're going to be in trouble.
Yeah,
The eastern newt, another very common species found throughout most of eastern North America. Again, another unusual life history strategy in the fact that they go through almost like a three-phase life cycle. So you'll have, again, your aquatic larvae is going to go through metamorphosis, but rather than eventually growing into an adult, they go through this terrestrial, so known as an F stage, is what you see here in this picture. So you can kind of think of like an adolescent phase in humans, essentially. And this is probably the most common life stages you're going to find in the forest floors, and they can be quite abundant, kind of characteristic. They don't have costal grooves, or these grooves that you sometimes see in some salamanders. You kind of basically mark where the ribs are located. They lack those, kind of a granular type skin, but it'll be 2-3 inches long, similar size limbs, and like these distinct red spots. This is also known as a red spotted newt. You can see here it's kind of diagnostic for the group. They can be reddish in coloration, they can be orange, yellowish, they can be kind of this drab color. This is actually one from Cade's Cove. But again, you can still see those distinct red spots. That's kind of the diagnostic feature. After they go through that F stage, which usually lasts between 2 to 4 years, depending on the area, they'll actually go back into the water, some site fidelity there, where they'll transform again, kind of like the second metamorphosis or complete their metamorphosis into the adult stage, which develops the tail fin again. Develop gills, but it has very vascularized skin, so it's not near as thick as that F stage, where they spend the rest of their time in water for the most part. What's also kind of neat between the newts is that you can tell males and females apart during the breeding season quite easily. If you look at the hind limbs of males, they're going to have these black keratinized structures, which they basically use to hold on to the female during mating. Okay. But even in this photo here, you can see that kind of drab olive color, you see the distinct red spots. They can be quite dense too. One of the few species that is not afraid to walk along the forest floor after rain during the daytime, namely because they're quite noxious. Not near as toxic or potent as the newts out in out west, like Tarika, but it's definitely not a species that you want to pick up and lick or eat. It will have a bad effect on you. I've heard stories of Big Brody. You heard those stories about Big Brody out in the West. I think he was on a trip. He was teaching herpetology. This is one of the Brodies, if you're familiar with, did a lot of salamander work, and he was looking at relationships between like shrews and predation on these newts. But working with Tarika, and I don't know how true the story is. This has floated around a long, long time, and I've heard it 5 times, so I'll go ahead and share it with you guys. So apparently he took a herpetology class out, or a group of students out in the field, and working with Tarika and out around the campfire. And if you're not familiar with herpetologists or ichthyologists, they like to drink a lot. So obviously some alcohol is probably involved. But he picks up a newt and I guess decides to lick it. And about 5 minutes later, said he dropped his beer. He was sitting at the campfire and was just sitting there with his mouth open and gape, drooling for like 20 minutes in a stunned state. So I guess that's how potent that is. And Big Brody, I think he was like 6'4", 290. So he was a big guy and did that to him. So lesson to be learned, don't stick things in your mouth that don't belong there. So they can be quite toxic. And so it's thought here in eastern North America that several species with their bright coloration, like red salamanders, Blue Ridge spring salamanders, maybe even like cave salamanders, are a mimic of the eastern newt. I'm not sure I necessarily buy that just based on the amount of variation that you see in their coloration. And to be honest, they're really not that bright and vibrant for the most part, ones that I come across. Okay, the three-toed Amphioma, very neat species. Has anyone ever seen an Amphioma in the field? They're wild, essentially look like an eel. But they have limbs. You see here, this is a three-toed Amphioma. You can see the front limbs. Obligately aquatic, it's pedomorphic again, so it's gonna be sexually mature in that larval stage, but it doesn't have those big exposed fluffy gills. They actually have a skin covering, you see here, actually getting most of their oxygen or gas exchange through the skin. but you see the long eel-like appearance, and this is actually the longest salamander that we have in North America. They get longer than hellbenders, but by weight, hellbenders are bigger. But they can get easily 3 feet. Very common in backwater sloughs and swamps, particularly around the Reelfoot Lake area. They're very, very thick. Nocturnal in nature, so they're going to be mostly out at night, where they feed on a whole host of things. But they specialize in another species of salamander known as a siren, which again has that similar body shape, elongated, but they have external gills that are exposed and only have their front limbs. They lack hind limbs. So they specialize on that. And it's kind of a neat kind of trophic exchange, because the sirens are preyed upon by the amphiumas, and there's a species of snake known as the mud snake, Francia avicura, which specializes on amphiuma. So pretty neat. They're all very long, slender, so you can just see one after the other eating each other. Again, like I said, they're very, very common. Also inflict a very, very nasty bite. They have rows of razor-sharp teeth in their mouth. They look like they wouldn't be that vicious, but I've been tagged a couple times, and I don't want to be bitten again. it causes you to bleed quite a bit. And obviously with their eel-like shape, being a salamander, being very slimy, they're very tough to get a hold of. And so the way that we've typically have caught them, she's been accidental. We've been turtle trapping out at Reelfoot Lake, done a lot of work out there. We'll occasionally come up in the turtle traps. But this other technique that a good friend of mine, Brad Glorious, and I developed, we took crawfish nets, deep water crawfish nets. Essentially, it's a hoop, kind of a basket design, and then three strings going up to a float. Then you have this long pole with the tine, and you pick up the float, the crayfish kind of sit on the bottom. Well, you can use that to collect turtles, particularly small turtles like stink pots. You just bait it with chicken liver, or you bait it with just chicken back, something like that. You can get at the grocery store. Well, it turns out at night, amphiuma love chicken. And so they'll get into the nets, and you can just do the same thing. We were able to catch 40 to 50 easily within a six-week period, which is substantially more than what's been reported in the literature. We're still eventually going to write that up. I just haven't had time to do so. But yeah, they can be very abundant. We did a little marker capture work, and kind of our estimates within this one stretch of ditch right alongside Reelfoot, upwards 100 to 200 individuals in a 100-meter stretch, so pretty dense. Obviously, it's a fairly wide ditch, but still, just kind of shows you their abundance that they can have. Another neat thing about this species is that when it actually breeds, the female crawls right at the water's edge, where they'll take a few months to develop, hatch out. Obviously, then she'll work her way back in. And another neat kind of adaptation this species have is also shared with the siren, is that during periods of very dry conditions, where say their wetland or their swamp dries up, their ditch dries up, they will actually estivate and burrow themselves in the mud and kind of form this mucousy cocoon, like I heard lungfish and mudskippers do a similar type of thing, and can wait it out. And so areas that have been dry for 3-4 months, you can come back to after a big rain once inundated and catch sirens and amphiuma again. So as soon as that rain comes, it triggers them to crawl back out. So obviously a very neat adaptation they have for survival in dry conditions. And I think that's all I have. I guess we can try the videos again, unless you guys have any questions. Obviously, that's just a subset of what we have. That's about half the species or so that occur in the state. Obviously, many have very similar life histories to the ones that we've mentioned, particularly the Plethodon. It's most of the diversity that we have is within the genus Plethodon throughout the state.